Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jason Kapoor, and I've been monitoring the investment space throughout my entire career. Here at Seeking Alpha, I'm an ETF strategist, and my role is to uncover and bring forward news and information to the investor community that is meaningful and actionable. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investment goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platforms you prefer.
For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the afternoon of June 28th, 2021. Our guest joining the podcast today is Simeon Hyman, Global Investment Strategist and Head of Investment Strategy Group at ProShares. Simeon comes to us today with a master's degree from the Columbia Business School. He is also a chartered financial analyst. And prior to joining ProShares, he has held the title of Chief Investment Officer for Bloomberg. Furthermore, he spent nearly 2 years with UBS and over 3 years with Lehman Brothers as well. Simeon, as mentioned, is currently a part of the ProShares team, where he is now approaching 8 years within the organization. We're extremely thrilled to have Simeon here with us today to discuss our topic of interest rates, inflation, and the effects they might have on the exchange-traded fund space. So with that, I'd like to introduce our guest, Simeon Hyman.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. How's everything going over there today?
It's hot. Very hot in New York.
Excellent. Well, the way we like to kick things off, Simeon, kind of really before we jump in the deep end of our topic today, is if you'd be able to give our audience a little bit of more information and details around you and your own self from a background standpoint, as well as ProShares, help paint a little bit of better picture of your organization and yourself.
Sure. Well, I've been in asset and wealth management for well over 20 years, and I came to ProShares, as you indicated, about 8 years ago, really wanting to be a part of a 21st century asset management solution. And we really strive to be that at ProShares. We're an ETF firm, and we're focused on, look, we're not one of the gargantuan three or four guys. So we focus on really differentiated solutions for clients. My team, if you think about my team, is the investment strategy group. I like to say that we do everything but pick the stocks, which sounds sort of funny, but remember, we're an ETF firm. So for the most part, our ETFs are following rules-based indices. But we have to do everything but pick those stocks, because we have to write about how these strategies perform, why they perform the way they do, how they would fit into portfolios, and really be the spokespeople and the creators of intellectual capital around them, literally doing everything but pick the individual securities. And that's the role we play at the firm.
Excellent. So with our topic obviously being around the interest rates and inflations, I got to start off by saying transitory inflation. You know, I think that it might be the phrase of the year. I saw the other day that Bank of America came out and mentioned in a note that I believe they're potentially seeing inflation to remain elevated for up to 4 years. I've also seen reports by PIMCO that said essentially the opposite. They believe that, you know, we're going to come down to 1.5% somewhere in 2022. With all the opinions swirling around, how does an investor make sense of it all? And ultimately, where does ProShares have their outlook on inflation moving forward?
So the way we think about inflation and interest rates, they're very, very closely related, though they don't have to do the exact same thing, is, and this is the big, sort of the big backdrop, we think that inflation and interest rates are going to rise enough to be detrimental to bonds, but probably not to stocks. So let's unpack that for a minute. As an example, we're running somewhere around, the last inflation number was well over 3%. So I think if you force me to answer whether that was sort of a transitory peak, I would say to some extent, yes. Why? I'm going to go old school. capacity utilization. We have never had runaway inflation of any sort without capacity utilization. That is the proportion of capacity that's employed in the economy right now. We've never had runaway inflation without capacity utilization going over 80. We're at 75 right now. Now, by the way, the typical range is something like 70 to 85. In fact, the lowest we ever got was in the Great Recession, which I think was down to somewhere around 60. So 75 is pretty far away from 80. That tells me that there isn't a lot of real perpetual ongoing inflation pressures, which sort of indicates that, yeah, I think some of this 3 and 4% numbers are really just some supply chain breakages. Now, it's important to note, though, that let's just assume that we settle into something like a Fed target 2%-ish inflation over time. It's important to note that that has real implications for interest rates. I go by the old 2+2=4 rule, which is that in the US 10-year treasury rate over the longest period has averaged about 4%, which is 2% comes from 2% inflation and 2% real. So if inflation is maybe a little transitory and we settle back down to close to 2, it doesn't mean that the coast is clear with regards to bonds. Do I think we're going to 4% on the 10-year in the next 12, 18, or 24 months? No. But even halfway there, the Bloomberg consensus for next year is 2.2%. That's enough to do damage to bonds. You know, a 10-year duration and a 50 to 75 basis point increase in rates, you're out 5 to 7.5%. But if we stay in that low 2 range, that easily supports a 20-plus PE, which is kind of where markets are on 2021 earnings.
Excellent. I appreciate that kind of feedback. I feel that a lot of people, when we talk about inflation, it's kind of the boogeyman in the room, and it's, you know, it's all bad or it's all good. And there's no kind of hyperlink in between the two. And I like that you mentioned that it's possible that we can be in a settled situation, but that doesn't give it the green light for the bond space. And things could kind of change around. You know, I do want to also say that the word inflation, and I kind of just hinted at it, kind of becomes synonymous with that, you know, boogeyman, bad, advantageous word. But in considering how much the government's balance sheet has grown since the start of COVID-19, isn't some degree amount of inflation a good thing in terms of making it easier for the U.S. to pay down debt? I mean, also in theory, when the economy is not running at full capacity, which it's particularly not, you know, inflation theoretically helps increase production, which equals more aggregate demand. More demand will give you more production to meet that demand and so forth. And the cycle goes on. But what are your thoughts around this as, you know, some inflation is not, you know, the worst thing in the world and it can be overblown by, you know, headline thoughts?
For sure. And I want to focus on the sort of second half of the comments that you made. A little bit of inflation with regards to sort of, you know, helping the government pay down debt. I'm not going to pass on it, but I'm going to sort of park it and not talk too much about it, because I think that the whole new monetary theory and all that stuff, that is less important than perhaps than the second set of things that you talked about. Sure. We need a little bit of inflation for the economy to be kicking in on all cylinders. I mentioned that capacity utilization number. We also know the Fed is obsessed with the unemployment rate. We know we can tick a little bit lower on that. And a little bit of inflation, there's a reason why the Fed is targeting 2%, because that's the kind of inflation that will, over time, generate the most real economic growth. We do not want to be in a Japan-like scenario. You know, I'm old enough to, you know, remember that at one point, Japan was going to take over the world from a financial standpoint. And they bought, you know, every piece of real estate in Midtown Manhattan, and then it just didn't happen. And a lot of that was demographic-driven deflationary spiral. So it is critically important that we have a modest amount of inflation to generate the most real economic growth. And that's the key to a healthy fiscal situation for the government. And it's also the key for a healthy backdrop for equities. There is a reason why equity multiples have tended to be quite high when interest rates are in that, you know, kind of 2% range. First of all, number one, the equities are a discounting mechanism. So by definition, you're going to have a higher multiple when interest rates are lower. But it's also because that can be a little bit of a Goldilocks. If we can hang in there, even 2.5% inflation for a little bit wouldn't be a big deal. But if we hang in there in the range of what the Fed's trying to achieve, that's going to be very good for corporate earnings growth as well, supporting equity prices.
Awesome. And I guess on a somewhat related note, you know, with high yield spreads now, being at historic lows, with this in mind, what do you believe this outlook might have on, say, the banking sector? Shouldn't almost higher inflation lead to a wider spreads in the future? And is that something that investors should be analyzing, maybe looking towards as indication?
So I'm going to split this up into two pieces, because a little bit of inflation and, of course, some higher interest rates, and particularly an upwardly sloping curve, is of benefit to banks. But before I get there, I want to just give a little color on what banks look like in the fixed income market. So it's actually the case that the preponderance of corporate bank debt is investment grade. So in fact, if you look at a garden variety investment grade bond index, you will see somewhere between 25 and 35% is banks. And they're only a small part of the high yield market. So with respect to corporate bonds, you're talking primarily investment grade. Now, high yield spreads with respect to interest rates, that is very similar to the conversation that we just had about equities and interest rates and inflation. So again, in other words, a little bit of inflation and a little bit of rise in interest rates, most of the time they go together, not all the time, we'll talk about that, is generally good for high yield spreads. So in fact, right now, high yield spreads are pretty tight, but upgrades are happening all over the place because this hopefully modest amount of inflation, cross your fingers, has certainly been good for corporate earnings. And when corporate earnings and cash flow are strong, you're going to get spreads come in. So they've come in a lot already, but the upgrades are coming in commensurate, and they could even come in a little bit more, though one couldn't deny that the low-hanging fruit from, you know, 18 months ago is not quite there anymore.
Interesting. And I guess taking it to the table of pro shares, I noticed that you guys have obviously a very diverse lineup of different exchange traded funds that are offered to the investment community. But for market participants that are concerned about, you know, rising rates and inflation concerns, what are some of the best ways to play this trend from within pro shares lineup? Are there any ETFs worth examining that you believe?
Indeed. And I'll give you four ideas. I hope that's not too many, but we got 30, 40 minutes, so we'll try to digest them. I used to go by a rule of two ideas maximum when you're, you know, sort of on the road and there are lasagnas and boxes of pizza in the back of the room, but we'll try four. And I'll list them, and then we can go through them and digest a little bit.
Sure.
There's one equity idea. It's our Equities for Rising Rates ETF. That's EQRR. And it focuses on the sectors and the companies that have been most correlated with strong performance when you actually have rising rates. And then on the fixed income side, we have a pair of interest rate hedged ETFs. So it's kind of like 3.5 ideas. IGHG is our investment grade interest rate hedged ETF, which staples a hedge against rising treasury rates to a portfolio of investment grade bonds. And its sister ETF is HYHG, and that's high yield. Again, offering a sort of, in technical terms, a regular portfolio of high yield bonds hedged against rising treasury rates. And then the last idea is RINF, R-I-N-F, and that is our inflation expectations ETF. And this deserves a tiny bit of unpacking, but this actually takes a TIPS portfolio and hedges the treasury rate risk out of that. That probably just confused everybody, so we'll unpack that, but it's worth 2 or 3 minutes of education on that one. So 3.5 ideas.
Sure. You want to start with equities? Want to stick with EQRR? We'll go in order.
Yeah. So in EQRR, we do two things. It's kind of a double screen. First, we look for sectors that have been most correlated with strong performance when rates are rising. And then within those sectors, we look for the stocks that have been most correlated with strong performance when rates rising. The easiest way to think about it is just to tell you what that sector composition is. We talked just a few minutes ago about how financials tend to react quite well when interest rates are rising. And indeed, financials are about 30% of the portfolio. Another 25 plus is energy, and another 20% is basic materials. If you're looking for the reflation trade, we package it up for you. So it's exactly what you think it ought to be. And in fact, it's performed double the S&P year to date.
Awesome. And then I guess from the fixed income standpoint, we have IGHG, which is the interest rate hedged investment grade ETF. And then we also, you mentioned, I believe you said high yield interest rate hedged, HYHG. Is that correct?
HYHG, you've got it.
Awesome.
So here, we looked at the landscape and said, look, when interest rates are rising, duration is your enemy because duration is your sensitivity to increases in rates. When rates go up, when the yield on a bond goes up, its price goes down. Now, if you have, say, a portfolio with a duration of, say, 10, okay, so if rates went up 50 basis points, a half a percent, you lose 5%. So most people say, well, I guess I better shorten the duration. I better use short duration bonds in my portfolio. Now, the problem with that is it's indiscriminate because a bond treats all changes in yield the same. It's just math. It's duration times a change in yield. And it doesn't matter where that change comes from. Now, a corporate bond's yield has two components. One is its treasury yield, and the other is the spread over it, the corporate bond spread. Because, as we were discussing, most of the time when rates are rising, there's a little bit more inflation, the economy's getting better, spreads tighten. It's exactly what we've been experiencing. So if you just shorten your duration, you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater because you're getting rid of all your credit exposure, which you kind of want in an environment where rates are rising. That's why these two ETFs are, we think, a very good surgical solution, because you are keeping all the good credit stuff and you're only hedging out the treasury risk. You're only hedging out the interest rate risk. And that's what IGHG and HYHG do. And, you know, as an example, IGHG year to date is up about 2.5%. It can't cure world hunger. That's investment grade bonds, but it's a lot better than the opposite. If you look at the unhedged investment grade index, it's down 2.5% year to date. I know we had this 6-week plateauing of rates, but from January, they've gone basically straight up. And very similarly on HYHG, offering the opportunity to have high yield bonds with the interest rate hedge. Just as a little bit of an extra note on this, it's kind of the don't try this at home story. If you wanted to hedge your own bond portfolio, you can't just kind of get one hedge, one point on the yield curve, because the yield curve could steepen, flatten, it could twist. In these ETFs, we hedge multiple points on the yield curve and rebalance every month. So you have nothing to do.
Excellent. Interesting. And then finally, point 3.5 we got is ProShares Inflation Expectation ETF, RINF. And so, would you be able to give us a dive into that one?
Okay, so you got to follow the bouncing ball on this. Everybody thinks that TIPS have no interest rate risk. Wrong. They have a ton of interest rate risk. So what you benefit from in a TIP is an increase in break in inflation expectations. But the TIP is still a regular bond. It's still a regular treasury. So if the underlying interest rate goes up, meaning just that 10-year went up, then you're going to lose money. Now, it turns out, and what we do in RINF is we take a portfolio of the 30-year break-evens, and then we hedge the interest rate risk out, not dissimilar from the way we do it in IGHG and HYHG, but we're hedging out the treasury rate risk from the TIP portfolio. The easiest way to see why that matters, year-to-date, the standard TIP index is up 1%, because you basically had nearly a perfect offset of the treasury rate's rising and the break even's rising. They washed each other out. RINF is up 11%.
Excellent. I wasn't aware of that. And I, even the idea that TIPS is, you know, how people have that assumption with it, I never really thought of it that way.
The institutional guys talk about the break-even inflation trade all the time. And then the sort of private client and retail people talk about tips all the time. And I find, at least for me, the easiest way to think about break-even is interest rate hedge tips. To me, it's just a little easier to think about than, oh, I have an option on break-even inflation, which is, yeah, you could think about it that way. But I think for me, it's easier to think of it as interest rate hedge tips. And then when you look at the performance, you see it right away. Aha, I get it. Tips are up 1%, but if I hedged out the rate risk and only benefited from increasing break-even inflation, I'm up 11 this year.
Interesting. And so where would you kind of play these exact strategies? I mean, I know that, and the way I put it is, you know, people have it from, they're always worried about, you know, hold times and where does it fit in my portfolio today. Do you see these as, you know, something that you should just always have as packages within your portfolio? Or is it, you know, more of, because look, this is the time that we're talking about it today. I mean, everyone on the street is constantly inflation. And, you know, it's the hot button. And that's why I'm sure investor flows will maybe drive toward it today. But is this something that you think can hold water, you know, I guess, as a long-term investment portfolio?
So these are unabashedly regime-based products, meaning that they're not quite evergreen. But I used to run the Lehman Trust Company. By the way, I was there till the end, the bitter end. So if anybody wants to follow up and talk about the last days of Lehman, that was fun.
We'll close on that one.
we can enjoy it. I still refuse to see the movie. But you know, when you're a fiduciary like that, you know, you think about you have an investment policy statement, and you have a basic asset allocation, and you have tactical tilts. But when you have those tactical tilts, you're talking about holdings that you're thinking about for 12, 18, 24, even 36 months. So when I say these aren't evergreen, I mean, you're not going to set them and forget them for the next 10 years. But we're not suggesting these as day trades whatsoever. These are things that, from a regime standpoint, are probably important to hold in your portfolio for at least another year, if not even a little bit longer than that. So to put a little context. Now, in terms of portfolio construction, first, let's start with EQRR. There are a couple of ways you could use EQRR. First, you know, if you do have a kind of core satellite approach to your equity allocation, this is a great alpha satellite. But also, you could put it in core. If you are looking at it from a sector standpoint, you might have a little bit of a value tilt. So you could certainly put it in your core portfolio for the next couple of years. On the fixed income side, it's important to note that IGHG and HYHG are corporate bonds. And of course, RIMF is treasuries. And that's the way I start to think about this is you look at the aggregate bond index. So the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index is about 50% treasuries, 25% agencies, mortgage backs, and about 25% corporates. By the way, the agencies and the treasuries have no credit risk. So, you know, a plain vanilla treasury, not a tip, but just a plain vanilla treasury, you would never hedge the interest rate risk out of, because the only thing it has is interest rate risk. So you'd just be recreating cash. So the role here of in the corporate side for IGHG and HYHG is to deploy them in that 25%+ of your taxable bond allocation. That's where it belongs. Some people will upsize it a little bit, maybe to 30 or 35% corporate bonds. A lot of people think the ag's a little light corporate, but it should not be the entirety of your portfolio. RIMF is an interesting animal. Even though it is a treasury instrument, you still have this optionality on break-even interest rate, which means that it's not quite behaving like the safety of a treasury, but you have taken down your interest rate risk substantially. So RIMF could be used in one of two ways. One, it could be used as a portion of that 50% treasury allocation, not the whole thing, but you know, maybe 10 or 20 of the 50. Also, you can cleverly use RIMF, and by the way, you could also use IGHG this way, at the bottom of a bond ladder. It's a very clever approach, but if you use these at the bottom of a bond ladder, you could squeeze a little extra return out of them while still having zero interest rate risk. So that's a little bit of an extra twist. Corporate bond slice for IGHG and HYHG, RIMF, a slice of your US Treasury allocation, and then IGHG and RIMF could cleverly be at the bottom of a bond ladder.
Awesome. And I appreciate the in-depth approach on that. I'm thinking the average person wouldn't have came up with that on the fly. So thanks for the input on all of that. And I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk to you a little bit about some of the key leading data indicators that market participants should maybe be looking at that may sway the Fed's overall outlook on rates and inflation, and what economic events or data points possibly can give investors a little bit more of a clearer indication of forward guidance. You know, obviously coming to mind, I'm thinking CPI and unemployment, but I was always curious to know if there's other factors that you might think are key to learn and key to understand. I think at different times in the markets, different economic indicators and economic outlooks are more appropriate at different times. So I was kind of just curious to hear your point on, you know, the forward guidance data. What should people be on the eye for?
Yeah, I mentioned capacity utilization. If that measure gets anywhere near 80, I think the old school alarms are going to go off at the Fed, and that will prompt some. You got the two levers, right? There's either the unwinding of tapering. Or the unwinding of tapering, that was redundant, tapering, the unwinding of bond buying, or an actual increase in the Fed funds rate. So I think capacity utilization is one. And then, of course, I think you have to take Powell at his word. They want much lower unemployment, you know, something around 4% and we're at 6%. So I think if you take those two indicators. But what I want to remind everybody of is those are the indicators for what the Fed, that what would trigger the Fed to start to change its behaviors. But remember the big gap we have between what those interest rates are right now and their long-term tendency. We're at 1.5 on the 10-year, and even if inflation's 2, I mentioned that somewhere in the 4-4.5 range would be a regular 10-year bond yield. Now, you can attribute that big gap to quantitative easing. It's not 100% clear if that's the only reason. But the reason I bring up that gap is we can get some level of part way to that normal 4-4.5 without the Fed changing anything. The Fed could just sit on its hands and we could easily get to 2-2.5% on the 10-year without any talking about tapering and without any increase in the Fed funds rate. So I encourage everybody to keep that in mind, because your bond portfolios are at risk even if there aren't any signals that require some sort of tantrum-like behavior from the Federal Reserve or market participants.
Yeah, and I was going to actually also just piggyback and ask you, you know, in planning for, I guess you could say, the unknown or the worst case scenario kind of approach, you know, what if inflation is not really transitory in nature, as the Fed continues to state? You know, what if it kind of remains elevated higher than expected and for a longer time frame than expected? What will happen to the markets and from a short term and from a long term standpoint? You know, what should someone look for in that kind of, you know, pardon my French, but you know, what kind of moment?
If inflation is sustained at 3% instead of 2 for a couple of years, that is unlikely to do any damage to risk assets, equities, most obviously. If you start to talk about something that starts to approach, you know, 5-7%, then you could have a downdraft in the equity markets, because that would really force real tightening from the central banks around the world to get that under control. It certainly strikes, I think, most of us that real runaway inflation is quite unlikely. But that's the risk. But 3%, I wouldn't worry about it. 5 or 6, okay, that's going to start to impact the equity markets. And you know, if that's the case, you want to be invested in aside from a strategy like EQRR, you also can think about high quality companies like consistent dividend growers, who can grow their dividends faster than even those higher rates of inflation.
Excellent. And it's been great for you to, that you've given us a lot of insight in this space around this topic. And I can probably speak to you all day and all afternoon, but we are kind of coming to a close here. And usually we kind of leave it off where our guest has the opportunity to speak about kind of anything on their behalf. But I'm going to have to insist we hear a little bit about the Lehman closing as you were a part of that situation. We'd love to learn a little bit about that and get the insight on that. And also, if you could let our audience just understand a little bit more information about where they could find ProShares, yourself, be it LinkedIn, Twitter, et cetera, for more information.
Well, on the Lehman side, I'll just say it was sad. You know, we were all together there the last couple of weeks, and I have to say that it was such a great group of colleagues that I think virtually everybody I know is doing important and valuable things in financial services all around the virtual streets. So I'm still in contact with all those people, but sitting on a floor with them for a few weeks there was something I'd rather not go through again. But for those looking to get further information on ProShares, our strategies, and some great intellectual capital to help you think about how to deploy our strategies, we do post a lot on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. ProShares is on LinkedIn. You can look for us there in social media. And of course, ProShares.com has lots and lots of resources on all of the strategies that we talked about and some more stuff as well.
Excellent. Well, there we have it. Simeon Hyman, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for taking the time out of your day to discuss the topic of interest rates and inflation with myself and our listeners. But until next time, I'm your host, Jason Kapoel, and I'll be signing off. For disclosure purposes, Jason Kapoel is not long any ETFs discussed. Simeon Hyman is not long any ETFs discussed.